Hello, everybody. Welcome to Lecture 7 of the Human Action Part 1 course. I'd like first to wish everybody a happy Halloween. You can tell it's Halloween. I've got my mask on already. You're supposed to laugh at that. I'm just back. Last week, there was a very nice conference held at Callaway Gardens. It was the 30th anniversary of the Mises Institute. Ron Paul and Judge Napolitano were there. It was a very good conference. There were some of students in my courses were there, and there were some students from this class, Jeff Leskovar, who I think is here now, was one of the students, and I got to meet him and others who were in the class. It was very nice. Now, what we have today is a rather difficult chapter, because what's particularly difficult about it is that, as we'll see, Mises has some views on probability theory that are in certain aspects a bit unusual and not what you would expect, but that's just one of the topics that is in the chapter. But I think we have to be very careful in going over this chapter because, as I say, I think it's a fairly difficult one. Oh wait, that didn't work. Wait a second. There we go. Now, the point that Mises makes that we've talked about a little bit before, but it's a very important point, is that whenever we act, we assume that the future is uncertain. And why is this? Why do we assume the future is uncertain? Well, let's suppose that we know that something will happen. Say we know the sun's going to rise tomorrow. We're not in any doubt about this. Then, well, if we're not in any doubt about it, there's nothing we can do about it. There'd be no point in asking to try to prevent or help the sun rise. I have some rise. I suppose there's no point in trying to help the sun rise either, but I meant to say sunrise. So if we're going to act, we're assuming that the matter isn't absolutely fixed. If it's something that this is going to happen come what may, then there'd be no point to action. So you see, this is the way in which action presupposes that the future is uncertain. Now, that doesn't seem a very difficult point, and I said the chapter is fairly difficult, but I now want to complicate things a little bit, as I have a distressing tendency to do from time to time. I said that if we know that something's going to happen, then there'd be no point to doing anything about it. So we wouldn't act, to give an example of the sun rising tomorrow. But the complication I want to raise is, what if what we know is just that we will decide in a certain way in future? So what we're claiming to know with certainty isn't some event that's outside of us, but some future decision of our own. Suppose I say, I know that I will have eggs for breakfast this morning, said before I have breakfast. Now, if that's a counter instance to Mises, can anybody tell me, why would this example seem to be a counter example to Mises? Anybody? Well, Mises says, if we know, yes, he says, we know that something is certain, then we're not going to, we won't act. But here's a case where we know something is certain, namely that I'll have eggs for breakfast in this morning, but what I'm knowing is that I will act. So that seems to go counter to what Mises is saying. Now, we have two interesting comments here. Andrew says, well, since future events are uncertain, it would apply to our own actions would be the same. But you see, that's taking for granted that what Mises is saying is correct, but the example I'm giving is, well, can't you just know what you're going to do? If that's right, then that future event isn't uncertain. Now, Kendrick says intent doesn't equal action. Now, that's quite true that you can intend to, it can be the case you intend to do something, like you intend to raise an objection, you intend to shoot me, but you don't actually do it. But this isn't a case where I'm saying I intend to have eggs for breakfast this morning. This is where I say, I know that I, in fact, will have eggs this morning. And so it wouldn't be a case where your point is quite true, intent doesn't equal action, but it isn't directly on point here because this is a claim where I say, I know I'm going to act, but I never, that doesn't prevent me from action. Now, Joe Miller says, well, if there's certainty, action is not required. But in this case, it appears that it is required because just what I'm claiming to know is that I will act. It isn't that the eggs are somehow going to get into my mouth just entirely apart from anything I do. Precisely what I'm claiming is that I do know that I'm going to act. Now, John says knowledge is in action, but why can't, well, sometimes it may be, but we can also know things apart from action, presumably. Let's say I know that 2 plus 2 equals 4, but it doesn't involve my acting in any way. And then oh, I see I'm getting people going on this. Somebody said, Bob said, he's fixing to have eggs, it's not double dog certain. Well, but what if it is certain? And then another one from John Galt. He's creating definition of imaginary world of praxeology. You know, he wants this to apply to the world we live in. Well, all right, so I see I got you going in the discussion. Now let's look at it a little bit more. Now, so is this a counter instance to Mises in that he said, well, if you know that something's going to happen, then you're not going to do anything because you know that the thing will happen regardless of what you do. But I say, well, what if there's a case where just what you know is something that you will do? Is that a counter instance to Mises? Well, one way to answer is to limit Mises' claims that where we say what we can't know is that something will happen regardless of what we do, just like in my example of the sun coming up tomorrow. If we know that it's going to come up tomorrow, there's nothing we can do about it. So this leaves open that we can know what we will do in the future. But I don't think Mises would accept this, and he has a counter to this. He says, if we knew we would act, our supposed action wouldn't really be action. Say, I know I'm going to have eggs for breakfast, say, tomorrow morning. So if I know that when I'm acting, I would just be acting robotically. I'd just be carrying out what I knew I would be doing. But that isn't really action because action assumes freedom of choice. And I just see there's another comment here from Kendrick, to know the future absolutely, wouldn't it be something believed to be true? but can't know for certain it will actually happen in absolute terms. Well, a lot of people think that they see, well, you know, something in the future, we can't really know it. But I tend to doubt that myself. I don't see why we can't know things absolutely about the future. But it's a very controversial area. So what I want to do now, again, I'm complicating things perhaps more than we need to, but as I say, I'm sometimes like that, I hope not always, is me said, well, would say, if we claim to know what we're going to do in the future, then when we would be acting, we wouldn't really be acting because we wouldn't have any choice. It would be just doing what we know we were going, what we knew we were going to do. I knew, at, let's say at T1, I was going to have eggs for breakfast. So then at T2, when I actually eat the eggs, I'm just carrying out, I'm doing what I said I knew all along I would do, but then I don't have any choice about it. So I'm inclined to doubt Mises is right here, although as I say, it's a difficult issue, and I won't press the issue beyond this slide. You probably think I've gone on about it long enough. But what Mises is assuming in thinking that if I know now what I will do tomorrow, then when I do anything tomorrow, I'm acting robotically. He's assuming I couldn't change my mind tomorrow. I couldn't say tomorrow, well, I'm not going to have eggs after all. But I don't see that that's right. I could change my mind. I could tomorrow say, I'm not going to have eggs for breakfast at all. So I would have a choice. But all that follows from that is if I did, it would be false that I knew now what I would do tomorrow. You see, suppose I say, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow, it doesn't follow from that that I have to do tomorrow what I know I'm going to do today. It's just that if I don't do it, then the claim that I knew I was going to do it is false. Now, as I say, that's quite a difficult argument, but I won't go on with this any further. But I just raised it, I thought it's a very interesting philosophical issue. I see a question here from Andrew. Is it correct to say the statement I mean made only in the formal sense that any future action is uncertain, is true regardless of how badly or how certain a person thinks they will accomplish it? Well, here I think it's uncertain is not intended in the sense that, is intended in the sense more that the actor has to take it to be uncertain. I think it's from, this is from the point of view of the actor. So if the, let's say the actor thinks that there's something that is certain to happen, but in fact it isn't that certain. Let's say for some reason he thinks that there's some stone that's impossible to move, but in fact the stone could be moved, that would be a case where action is not possible. If he thinks there's nothing he can do to move a stone, then he's not going to do anything. So I think here Mises has in mind more the subjective point of view of the actor. Okay, now we want to shift to a different issue. It's also, I think, a very interesting philosophical one. And I just see one very interesting point Maury raises. Also, certainly I assume will be relevant to my mind, might not be present in the near future. I thought it might be. I could die before breakfast. Right. But remember, that doesn't prevent you from knowing now that you will have eggs before breakfast as long as, in fact, you don't die before breakfast. Remember, if I say I know something, this doesn't mean, imply it's impossible that that thing not take place. It's just that, in fact, it will take place and I fulfill whatever the necessary conditions for knowledge are. It's not, we're not claiming you can only know things that are logically impossible to fail to occur. That's a trap one has to avoid. A lot of people fall into that trap. You have to be a bit careful there. Okay, so like somebody said, makes your brain hurt. Okay, so now I want to raise another issue. It's also a very difficult one. As I told you, this is a tough lecture. Okay, now, from Mises' stress on freedom or condition of action, remember he's saying, well, if you're acting, he's not willing to count just robotic movement as an action, suppose I'm just sort of going through the motions. He doesn't want to count that as action. He said action involves genuine choice. So you might expect that he would reject the philosophical view called determinism. Now, what do we mean by determinism? Again, that's a difficult topic, but essentially we mean the view that events follow by causal laws from previous events, and there are no genuine alternative possibilities. So if, say, my speaking now is determined, then there are causes that have brought about my speaking, and the alternative of my not speaking, much as it might be desired by some people, was never a genuine possibility given these causal laws. But alternative possibilities seem necessary for action because, say, we say we're choosing A rather than B. Say, like my late friend Father Sadowski, we're choosing chocolate rather than vanilla ice cream. So, supposing he was determined to choose chocolate ice cream, so in what sense then was he choosing to take or acting if he was determined to take chocolate ice cream? Doesn't it seem he would be acting, at least according to me, only if he faced real alternatives? But if, say, he's determined to pick chocolate and not vanilla, then it seems he's not acting. So if this line of thought is right, you'd expect Mises to reject determinism because he's certainly assuming that we are acting. After all, praxeology is the science of human action, study of human action. So there's no such thing as genuine human action. That doesn't augur well for praxeology. So you'd expect Mises to reject determinism. But in fact, he doesn't. What he says is determinism may be true. It may be true that all events, including our ostensible actions, are a result of causal laws and previous conditions. So determinism may be true. And I think, in fact, he did think determinism was true, although he wasn't that firmly committed to it. But he says we don't know enough to predict particular events. So even if determinism is true, we really can't fill in the details. Now, I see a very interesting question. What about compatibilism, that determinism, free will, can coexist? That's a very interesting question. Mises really didn't consider that very much. I think he probably accepted. I know Hayek certainly accepted compatibilism because he told me that. But I think what Mises is talking about when he talks about determinism, what's called the hard determinism, the determinism that would preclude genuine free will, where we would say the person's ostensible action is really caused in such a way that he has no alternative to doing what he acts, and that's what Mises is concerned with it. So what Mises says is, maybe true, we don't know enough to predict particular events, and we have to assume freedom of action. So again, Mises is talking from the actor's point of view. So we don't really, according to him, we don't really need to make claims about whether it's true in some ultimate sense. I see we have a lot of good questions here, but I'll just answer a couple of them, but I do want to go on with the lecture so I don't get too confused. I'm confused already. Remember, it's Halloween, so you never know. That makes things even worse. Okay, so we have a question here. What is the difference then between fatalism and determinism? Determinism, now that's a very good question. Remember, determinism is just saying, suppose an event happens, then that event was caused to occur. Given the cause, then the effect follows. Now that doesn't say the effect followed by logical necessity, so it's impossible that the effect failed to occur. It just says, given the causal law, then the effect would happen. Now, fatalism, I think, would be the view that whatever happens must, in some very strong sense, happen, couldn't fail to occur. So that would be the difference. It would be, say, if I say I was determined to give this lecture, not in the colloquial sense that I'd set my mind to do it, but that I was caused to do it, then given these causes, I was going to lecture. But if it was fated that I lecture, then it was impossible to avoid lecturing. There's no possible world in which I failed to give this lecture. So Mises says, we have to assume freedom of action, but he's not claiming the metaphysical position that there really is such a thing as freedom of action. Now, with that as the preliminary, we can get into the real difficult stuff. You know, if you've stayed with me so far, I admire your fortitude. I certainly wouldn't have done it had I been in your position, but here we are. We now get into Mises' views on probability. Now, some of his views, incidentally, were derived from his brother, Richard von Mises, whom he very often didn't get along with. But his brother was one of the developers of the frequency theory of probability, and Mises accepted his brother's views with some modifications. So, probability, when do we speak of probability? When we know something but not everything about some future event. So we have some of the information about required to find out, to determine whether an event will happen, but not all of it. We know some things but not all of it. And there are two kinds of probability, according to Mises, which are class probability and case probability. So it's very important to keep those separate, because Mises constantly talks about this difference between class and case probability. Now, in class probability, we know everything about a class of events, but nothing about individual members of a class, except presumably, well, we do know they're members of the class, but we don't know anything other than that. What would be an example? Suppose you have a standard deck of 52 cards. So we can say that 4 out of the 52 are aces. We know there are 4 aces out of 52 cards in a standard deck. And that's equal to 1 out of every 13 cards is an ace, or another way of putting that is a standard deck has 4 suits, and each suit has 13 cards. One of each of those sets of 13 is an ace. So that's, we know that's, this is what we know about the whole class. We know that there are 4 aces out of 52. So suppose we say that the odds are 12-1 against drawing an ace. That's just another way, I made a mistake in, of saying that 4 out of the, should be out of the 52, not out of 13, or 1 out of 13 are aces. So according to Mises, suppose you say the odds are 12-1 against drawing an ace, that sounds like you're talking about the probability of that particular event. Let's imagine you have a deck of cards in front of you. You draw out one card. Sounds like you're asking about what is the probability of that particular event. To have drawn out an ace, what's the probability that that will turn out to be an ace? It sounds like a question about one particular event, but Levy said, no, that's not right. All you're saying, if you say the odds are 12-1 against drawing an ace, all you're saying is there are 4 aces out of 52 or 1 out of 13 cards is an ace. So this is the hard part about Mises on class probability. You're not saying anything at all about an individual case. You're just reiterating the general statement about the class. You're just saying this is what's true. You have to say the odds are 12-1 against drawing an ace. It's just making a general statement about the whole class. It's not making a statement about the individual event at all. So I said this already. So again, let's go over it again, because this is really crucial if you want to understand Mises' view of class probability. That Mises says that to say the odds are 12-1 against drawing an ace says nothing at all about the individual event of drawing an ace. It's only a statement about the class, that is, that 4 out of 52 cards are aces. And so to repeat, class probability does not apply to individual events at all. And this is a very counterintuitive view, because it seems like it does apply to individual, the statement does seem to be about individual events. It means it said, no, it's not. It's about the whole class. Now, while you're taking that in, I'll just pause. I'll give you a trivia question here. Mises, in the chapter, uses the word, remember, he has a very arcane vocabulary. He uses the term crematistic. He says crematistic considerations. C-H-R-E-M-A-S-T-I-C. Can anybody tell me what crematistic means? Ah, Leslie has it already. Yes, related to money. That's right. I didn't think people would get that, but that's very good. Okay. Now, so what Mises is saying, again, is that when you talk about when people talk about the probability of an individual event, like drawing an ace out of a deck of 52 cards, they're not really talking about the individual event at all. They're just saying in different ways, making some statement about the whole class. Now, sometimes people object to Mises that insurance companies will sell policies for some particular event happening or not happening. And they use probability calculus to do so. Say you can buy a life insurance company, so won't the company be selling you the policy based on certain statistics about your life expectancy? So is this is this go counter to me? So I'm just reading an objection. I see Joe Miller says if you draw all 52 cards, it's certain you get four aces. One in 13 is merely an uncertain deduction. Oh, that's a very interesting point. Well, the claim wouldn't be that if you pick out any 13 cards you want, you're guaranteed to get an ace. It's just that the proportion 4 out of 52 is equivalent to 1 out of 13, but you're right, it doesn't follow from there being 4 aces out of 52, that for any 13 cards at random, there's guaranteed to be an ace. That's a very good point you raised. Okay, so the objection is, well, Ibn Mies is wrong because he says you can't use probability calculus for individual events. Probability calculus only applies to class, and you only use it for class probability. And in class probability, you're only making statements about the whole class. But don't insurance companies use probability calculus for individual events? So is this a good counter to Mises? Well, as you can expect, he doesn't think so. What he says is that the insurer isn't relying on probabilities for individual events. So the insurer, say if you buy a life insurance policy and the insurance person looks up your age and your various medical records and says, okay, I'll sell you the policy for such and such money, he isn't relying on an individual probability that you're going to die in so-and-so many years. Like, say, I buy a life insurance company policy. Says, well, okay, you have 2 weeks life expectancy, so you're really going to have to pay an exorbitant amount of money. What he's doing is just taking going for a whole class. So what he's not making a bet on you in particular. He's just saying if you get a lot of people, then he'll have enough for a whole class, and he does have exact statistics on the whole class. So it doesn't matter to him whether he's not trying to figure out what individuals will do or how long they will live. He's just trying to just has information about the whole class. Now, Mises makes a distinction here. I should have put this down on the slide, but I didn't, between a gamble and a bet. Now, a bet is something we'll talk about later, is something involving the other type of probability, which is called case probability. But a bet is something, a bet is something about case probability, but a gamble is something like where you're making, risking money on an individual event where class probability applies. So supposing, say, you go to Las Vegas and you're betting on the roulette wheel. So Mises would interpret things, class probability applies because we know, say, in roulette, what classes red will turn up in certain number of times in taking a whole class of events of the wheels turning, but we're not, if we make a bet on an individual turn of the wheel, then it's gambling because the probability calculations don't apply to particular events. So the owner of the casino will be sure he's going to make money, because if you have a whole lot of turns of the wheel, you'll have the behavior of a whole class of turns. But each individual turn of the wheel is a gamble, and according to Mises, we can't make any probability statement at all about that, because that's just based on class probability. Now, I want to emphasize, I said this before, but that won't stop me from saying it again, Mises' position certainly seems counterintuitive, which is a fancy way for saying it seems like there's something wrong with it, but he sticks with it. For example, supposing I buy a lottery ticket where I own one ticket out of a million sold. So I say, suppose I say, it's extremely unlikely that if I own one ticket out of 1 million sold, that I'm going to win the lottery. That seems like a reasonable thing to say. But according to Mises, all I'm saying there is I own only one ticket out of 1 million. So supposing I, in fact, win the lottery. It's a nice thing to suppose. Why not? So according to Mises, I couldn't say afterwards, well, something extremely unlikely happened. I could certainly say I was lucky, but I couldn't say something almost astronomically unlikely happened, because according to him, probability calculus doesn't apply to individual events at all when we're dealing with class probability. So again, that seems an unusual position, but that's what his theory commits him to, and that's what he says. Now, we now want to talk about the type of probability that does apply to individual events. Remember, class probability, we know everything about the class and nothing about the individuals in the class, except we do know they're members of the class. We don't know anything about the individuals. Now, the second kind of probability does deal with individual events. So in this, what we know here are some of the factors that produce an individual event, but not all of them. So you see, here's a contrast with class probability. Remember, class probability, we don't know anything at all about what produces an individual event. All we know is we know everything about the class, nothing about the individual event. Here we know some things, but not everything about the individual event. So Mises says, if that's the case, probability calculus doesn't apply to case probability. The probability calculus applies only to class probability. Where, remember, in class probability, you know everything about the whole class, but nothing about the individual members of the class. Now, I want to raise an objection, which is continuing the point where I said Mises seems to be making counterintuitive, has a counterintuitive view. The objection would be, there's an interesting point here that John Galt makes. Is not a class a collection of individual events? Sure it is, you're perfectly right, but that doesn't contradict anything Mises is saying. Mises is saying, in class probability, we don't know anything about these individual events other than they're members of a class. So that's consistent with what Mises is claiming. So the objection is, suppose we make a statement like the odds are several million to one against my holding the winning lottery ticket. The objection is, if I make that statement, doesn't it seem like I am talking about an individual event, not just the class of what which is a member? It doesn't seem to be right, on the surface at any rate, to say, when I say the odds are several million to one against my holding the winning lottery ticket, that that statement can be translated into the statement, I hold, say, one ticket out of 3 million sold. It seems like I'm, that's no doubt true, but it seems like I'm making, on the basis of that, minuscule proportion of the tickets that I own, that I'm saying it's extremely unlikely that I'm going to win. So it seems like I am, contrary to what Mises says, talking about an individual event, not just the class of which it's a member. So what Mises has an answer to this, which I think is a very interesting one. He says, I can certainly make a statement about an individual event where I mention numerical odds. I can say the odds are several million to one against my holding the winning lottery ticket, or what would I say, the odds of my becoming the next president are a billion to one against. But he says, if I say that, or statements like that, I'm just making a metaphorical statement. I'm not saying something that's literally true. So what I'm doing there, if I say the odds are several millions of one against my holding the lottery ticket, I'm just expressing a judgment of mine that I'm almost certainly going to lose. I'm not saying I've applied the probability calculus and it turns out the individual probability of my winning is several million to one against. Why can't I say it? Because remember, according to Mises, probability calculus doesn't apply to individual events. All I can do with individual events is make judgments of my own about them. I can make judgments of something's likely to happen, not likely to happen. But these aren't, I can't strictly use the probability calculus in making these individual judgments. Again, because probability calculus applies only to classes of events, not to individual events. Just one sec here. Sorry, I didn't do that. Okay, now Mises, now he's gone through probability theory. He now turns to another topic, and here he shows that he was quite familiar with a contemporary work that had been published by John von Neumann, contemporary of human action, book called Theory of Games and Economic Behavior. It was written by the great mathematician John von Neumann and also by co-authored with Oscar Morgenstern. Morgenstern had been a student of his. So what those writers did was try to analyze economics in terms of game theory. And this is a very popular approach. You can read textbooks today that will present economic theory about games. Well, I guess the question here from John, can probability calculus be applied to gambling? Well, Mises says you can certainly apply it to classes of events that happen in gambling, like numbers of roulette deals, but he strictly thinks it doesn't apply to individual events, just to classes of events. Okay, so getting from gambling to games, so Mises doesn't like games, the use of the term games for economics, because in a game, you're aiming to defeat the opponent. Say, if you're playing chess or checkers, you're trying to win. Now, suppose you say, well, can't there be games where you don't try to defeat the opponent like solitaire. And Mises said, well, no, that's just a pastime. He would say games involve an effort to defeat the opponent. So Mises says, well, this isn't really what's going on in the market, the free market. In the free market, it is true that there, say, some businesses will compete with others. Say you have a restaurant and somebody else has a restaurant and you're trying to draw customers. There are a certain number of customers, so they could go to your restaurant or the one down the block. So you could say, well, you're in competition with them. But what's going on there is the process of seeing who can serve the consumers best. So if you have the better restaurant, say people go to your restaurant, people stop going to the other person's restaurant, then that person is eventually going to have to shift to another occupation. That person will lose money. So what we're doing in the market really is not engaging in a process where one person, say, will defeat the other person or try to overcome it, but we're just engaging in the process of seeing who can best serve the consumer. And the process is moving people to the positions where they're best suited to serve the consumer. So in a game, it's just sort of one person or one team against the other. So if you have two baseball teams competing, say the Giants against the Tigers. So all that's happening there is each team is trying to beat the other one. But there's nothing that corresponds to figuring out which one is better suited to serve the consumer. There's no outside aim that by which you're judging the participants. It's just there are particular rules of the game. Say in baseball, the one that gets the most runs in the game is the winner. So it's just one team against the other. But economic activity isn't like that. So Mises is very doubtful about the use of the games to notion of games as a way of analyzing economics. Now, whether game theory actually depends on this notion of games that Mises is talking about is correct or not is an interesting question, but Mises certainly assumes it is, and he made a fairly close study of the book. I think at one point he cites the von Neumann's Morgenstern as saying that the monopolist could be taken as equivalent to playing solitaire, and he rejects that. And he cites the economics, theory of games and economic behavior, page 86 or something. You'd have to look that up. And so he's evidently made a pretty close study of the book. Now, I've so far said that Mises is, we're talking in this chapter about uncertainty. Mises is saying the future is uncertain, and if we the future were certain, then we wouldn't act. And then I'm mentioning that he says class probability doesn't apply to individual events. Now we can have, he says we have case probability that does apply to individual events, but here we're not able to use the probability calculus. And I should say, I should have mentioned this before, but I didn't. It's an important point that the historian is making judgments of case probability, because remember, the historian, according to Mises, will try to figure out what particular actor knew and what his value judgments were, what he wanted. He'll try to explain people's actions in terms of that. So that's called specific understanding when he's trying to do that. So the historian won't be in a position to know absolutely everything about an actor's state of mind, but he'll just have to make judgments about an individual case. So if you're trying to judge why did Caesar cross the Rubicon in 49 BC, so you say, well, he did that because he really wanted to get into the history textbooks. You're just making a probability judgment based on your assessment using case probability. So far, as I say, what Mises is doing is he's emphasized what we don't know. But here, at the end of the chapter, he has one section which he calls praxeological prediction, where he says, well, using the laws of praxeology, remember praxeology is an a priori science. We know without justification from experience that the claims of praxeology are true because they're deduced from the concept of action. So he says we can sometimes make general predictions that we know are true. An example, and you'll be giving the reasoning behind this later, but he gives an example, is that a minimum wage law will cause unemployment, other things being equal. Now, why do we know that? Well, in a minimum wage law, it says wages can't go below a certain amount, which will have for the be above the what the market wage was, at least in some cases. So at the market wage, demand equals supply. This is something you'll learn about later, or you probably already know if you studied economics already. So if we have a minimum wage law that says that it says the price can't, or labor can't go below a certain point, and that's above the market price, so at that price, there'll be more labor supplied than employers want to take, so that's why there's going to be unemployment. So that's something, according to Mises, we know is going to happen because it's just based on these general laws of praxeology. But we can't make quantitative predictions. And why not? Because remember, there are no numerical constants in human action. The laws of praxeology are just based on the concept of action. This is not quantitative concepts, just general truth about action. And there aren't inductively derived quantitative laws because, again, remember we covered this in one of the earlier lectures, there's just too many variables in human action to establish inductive laws. We can't perform controlled experiments. I see there's a question from John Gull. Can Sterling make quantitative predictions or just quantitative statements of the past? Mises would say just quantitative statements about the past. We can't perform the controlled experiments we would need to try to come up with quantitative laws, so we can't make such predictions. Well, all right. Well, I think that's it for today. I've given you quite some difficult material, and thanks for staying with me. So we'll now open it up to the questions and answers. I see one from Malcolm. Do you agree with me that we have to assume freedom of action? Well, certainly if we're going to do praxeology, we have to. I mean, that's the basis of praxeology. So, I mean, we're given this concept in our, it seems like a concept we wouldn't be able to understand the world without it. So I think we can say that we do have freedom of action. This is something that's given to us in experience, unless we have some reason to reject it, we should certainly think that we do have such freedom. Now here's one, another one. John Galt says, gambling, engineering, speculating are three ways of predicting the future. Knowing nothing about a class implies prediction based on no cause and effect relationship. I'm not sure I'm understanding that question too well. I mean, suppose you knew, if you have a, I think what your question is assuming, which some people would deny, you're right if statements of cause and effect relations involve general statements of the form events falling under such and such a class will cause other events in a different class. But you don't, there are some people who don't assume that. There are some people who say you can have an individualized cause. Some, you can say something brought something else about and not make any general causal law. You just say, suppose I say, I lifted up this glass and had a drink of water. And somebody say, well, I caused the glass to go up. If I say that, that doesn't assume that, it doesn't presuppose that there's some general law about what happens when I lift up my arm and what happens to the glass. Some people say, no, that's just an individual statement. So if you take that view, then predicting the future, knowing nothing about a class, wouldn't imply that there is no cause and effect relationship. Here's another question here. Okay, Malcolm said, were these non-zero sum games published when he was writing this? If not, how would you think this would alter Mises' view? Do you, Mr. Gordon, think the games are inherently zero sum as Mises stated at this time of human action? I think there are certainly non-zero sum games. I don't know when people did work on that, but I think that Mises, you could modify what Mises claims in this way, that his argument there wouldn't assume that the game has to be zero sum, but that the primer, I think all he'd need is the idea that a game primarily involves competition between the participants of the game and nothing beyond that. So you could have cases where there's a game to some or all the participants in a game, in a game, but the aim of the game is simply something that takes place between those participants. So he would still be contrasting games in this extended sense with the market, where what's happening on the market is people are trying to serve some good external, or people activities have the result of serving some goal external to what they're doing, namely providing for the wants of the consumers. Now, John says, that is by chance. Well, not on the view that this individualized view of cause, that individualized view of cause would say, sure, there's a cause for the event, but it's just not part of any cause. There's just no causal law, but that doesn't prevent it from being caused. I'm not saying that theory is correct, although I think there's a lot to be said for it. But that wouldn't be, on that view, wouldn't be a chance event. It would just be saying the event would be caused, but there wouldn't be a causal law for it. Now let's see, one by Andrew. How important is music theory class while building class on the Austrian method? Is this very controversial view among mainstream economists? Well, that's a very good question. I thought about this myself, actually. I think the theory of class probability that Mises gives is detachable from praxeology. I don't think he argues the concept of action involves that view of probability. That's just the view he happened to hold. And he thought that's an important topic. People make judgments about probability judgments when they're acting. He just wanted to give his view. I think theories of probability are a very controversial topic. I mean, everybody uses the same methods of calculation, but there are all sorts of different theories about it, very much discussed by philosophers who specialize in some subjects. So I think you're raising a very good point. I mean, it isn't strictly part of the praxeology that you have to accept that theory, but remember, Mises includes in human action a lot of material that isn't strictly praxeology. I think it might be a very interesting project to try to figure out what exactly is part of praxeology in human action. Now, here's another one from John Galt, Gamble Equals Wager Based on Understanding History of the Class. Betting is wager. Understanding history then. Yes, that's basically right. See, in a gamble, you're trying to make a wager on an individual event, but you don't know anything about the event because all you have is class probability, and that applies to the class, not the individual event. So a bet is based on case probability. Now, Jeff said, why did Mises include the discussion of case and class probability? As I say, it's just an important topic in action. I think also he thought he had some refinements on his brother's theory of probability, so I think he just put it in because he thought he had something important to say about it. Now, Leslie says, in this chapter with Mises trying to give theoretical reasons against the use of statistics in economics, class probabilities cannot predict individual events. The statistically based rules of behavior could not predict how consumers would act in an individual case. Ah, that's interesting, but you see, what would be the case in statistics, that would be not using probability theory, but that would be inductive generalization, presumably, and that he'd covered in earlier chapters. So I don't think this would directly, like you're saying here, probability theory wouldn't strictly apply to statistical inference. That would be something else, but I could be wrong here. Oh, I see Andrew, let's see, here's one from Andrew. Could the idea of a game be applied to competitors in the economy, or would the objection be that while we could theoretically conceive of a business with its sole goal of beating the competition, the only way of doing so is to serve a consumer, and such cannot be analyzed as a game? Yes, I think that's a very good insight there, that somebody could say, well, just what I'm aiming for is to knock that other idiot out of business down the street, but still, the only way I could do that is to attract more customers than the other person. So I wouldn't be, even though my aim is to put them out of business, still I'm part of a social process, the result of which is to move people into positions where they're best able to serve the consumer. So it's not strictly a game if that's defined, as Mises does, as something that has as its primary result, one person vanquishing another. I see one down in the Q&A. Roy says, you said last week you'd be covering time and uncertainty today, so is there a relationship? Well, I should have just said time we covered last week and it's uncertainty day. I mean, there is a relationship in that the future, obviously, is the time that's after where we now are. So we questions of prediction, uncertainty, and so on, don't arise except in connection with the future. So I think that's the relation there between the two. Okay, so we have here, Jane, we did that one. Okay, let's get on to this one. Another one from John. Knowing something about prophecy, but not everything provides prediction based on probability, that is prediction based on cause and effect relations. That's what's involved there, is just judgments about what's going to happen. Just, it can be based on your knowledge of cause and effect, and that there is sometimes just based on your estimates of what's going to happen. It wouldn't be something that's reducible to rules. You're just trying to figure out what's going to happen. Some people are much better at that than other people. Say businessmen who are very good at making judgments will be successful in a way that their less skilled competitors aren't. But it isn't that we're applying some causal laws that will give us sort of the result like some mathematical calculation. It's just a process of inexact estimation. Now, here's one from Joe. I think Mises went into trouble redefining probability mainly to show that case probability is not reliable, making quantitative prediction, which is vitally important in praxeology. Well, he certainly thinks you can't give exact odds. I think that's a very good based on probability theory, because there are no constants in human action. So he does, I think that's a good point. He does want to show that you can't get numerical probabilities for individual events. I think that sounds like you're right. Now, Andrew says, building on my last question, we say the game is to best serve the consumer. There's a point that your means isn't to harm, but to serve. I think that's a very good question. The point, principally, is that what's taking place in market competition is serving the consumer rather than defeating other people who are engaged in the same sort of serving the consumer as you are. So think of it in this way. Let's take an analogy with biological evolution. You could say certain animals will reproduce more than others, so they're the ones that will, in future, they'll have more descendants than others, and they'll eventually supplant the ones who are less productive. So the process of natural selection is, you could take as having the result that animals with certain traits are adapted to a particular environment will flourish as against ones that aren't. But what's happening isn't primarily a game between animals with some traits and animals with other traits, where the animals are attempting to vanquish each other. I see. Now, Andrew says that we talk about games here, or is that something different altogether? Well, that's a very good point. Mises tend to assume that game theory was dependent on this particular view of games that he opposed, but it may be that it isn't, say, game theory. I know it's been used in evolutionary biology, for example. So it may be that game theory, in fact, doesn't depend on the notion of game Mises was criticizing, but I think Mises thought it did. Now, John says, case probability, praxeology, speculating, fact, it's not implied knowledge of the event, some knowledge of a class of event. No, in case probability, we just know something about the event. We're not making any assumptions about the class event. We just know something about the individual event, but not everything about it. Oh, another good lecture. Yes, Joe Miller, good comment. That's an excellent comment. John says, we knew nothing but class events in case probability. Yes, I think the primary thing is we just know something but not everything about the individual events. I don't think Mises is really making any claims about the class of what we know about class of events. And now says all these questions are desktop in New York City, so you'll have to ask when I return back, stranded right now in New Orleans. Well, let's hope the dam doesn't burst there. Oh, someone asked about the quiz. Yes, I think we're a bit late. I sent in quizzes for 5 and 6, and they should be posted soon. Sorry about that. I have 7 ready to go. Now, here's an interesting question from Roy. In economics, there's a lot of talk about uncertainty, which is not measurable, and risk, which is measurable. Does Mises distinguish between the two? Yes. In fact, if you go further in human action, you'll see he makes a great deal of that distinction work. Risk is where you can apply probability calculus and uncertainty where you can't. There's a basic distinction that Frank Knight was one of the, probably the most important person to write about this in his book, Risk, Uncertainty, and Profit. So Mises makes very great use of that, exactly that distinction you raised. I didn't mention it here because it isn't part of our chapter, but it is covered later in human action. Now, Rock said, can you describe QE in a case class terms, or is it simply that QE just ignores the many possible outcomes? Now, QE is quantitative. I'm not really sure what the theoretical basis that the proponents of this quantitative easing have in mind. I think we would have to look at particular advocates of that policy to see what they meant. Now, somebody said panic was the basis. Well, That's probably right. And John says QE equals theft. Oh, that's probably true too. Now, Andrew says, would it be philosophically safe to say that nothing in life is certain? Oh, I don't think so. I don't think, I mean, aren't we certain of some things? I mean, aren't we, suppose you say I'm certain that 2 + 2 = 4, I'm certain I exist. Why should we think everything is uncertain? I wouldn't see I wouldn't see why one would want to say that. When it, Danny said he wrote that he wrote about class case probability here. Oh yes, I think I'm sure everybody would benefit from reading that. That would be very good to consult. I should have gone over that before my lecture. I could probably have simplified things had I gone over that, but I didn't. Like I said, did you meet? Yeah, yes, I did. I was surprised he remembered me. I suppose I've met him over the years. Yes, I was talking to him. I asked him actually, did he have a prediction on the presidential election? And he said he didn't think, not that it makes that much difference, but he thought he expected Romney to win. But he didn't give a probability judgment on it. After all, it's a particular event. Yes, I think we can be. Unfortunately, that's going to be the case. He expected, Stephen said, he told me he expected us, the people, to lose. Yes, that's unfortunately going to. Now, the two or one more lecture. Well, let's see, this is lecture 7, so there's one more lecture. I hope. That's all I've got. See, we have the introduction plus 7 chapters, which is 8 lectures. I think on course on part 2 of Human Action, I'm not mistaken, is going to be taught by Joe Salerno. Somebody had asked me about that, so that's my understanding. No, I'm sorry, I don't have any dates for that. Anil says, what would you say is the best recent exposition of Misesian praxeology? Well, I have to think about that. I mean, you know, there have been, other than the classic accounts, I think Hans Hoppe has a good pamphlet on the subject. That would be pretty good or excellent. I recommend that. Now Bob says, can we get slides posted, please? That really helped me. Well, Bob, don't you mean that reading the slides helps you? I mean, how would the process of posting them help you? I mean, wouldn't you, what would help you would be looking at the results of having them posted. Don't mind me, I just like saying things like that. Oh, we have to. Neil says, do you have any idea why Rand opposed praxeology? Don't they argue in the same general way? Well, what they don't like about praxeology is the notion that of a priori knowledge, where they say you're reading a priori knowledge, you're claiming that something justified apart from experience. If they think all knowledge comes from experience, so they don't like that. So I think that would be the primary thing. Now, I suppose you could reinterpret praxeology so that it's not assuming some kind of theory of knowledge that they reject. So you could probably get around their objections if you were inclined to accept their theory of knowledge. Now, Rock says, what would we say about Mandelbrot's spelling? I think it's B-R-O-I-T, fractal nature of markets. Well, that's a difficult question. I think what Mandelbrot did was to claim that there are certain statistical patterns in markets that don't conform to the way many people think they do, but they meet other relationships that he studied in particular. I think Mises tends to be skeptical about any claim of a general quantitative law about how the market operates. So I don't think I think Mandelbrot did his work quite a bit after Mises, but I would expect Mises would be skeptical about it. But you know, one can't really say that for sure. But he tends to be skeptical about it, about quantitative claims. Andrew said, if you'd sum up in Atlas Shrugged in one word, what would it be? How about explosion? Yeah, to me, the train scene, the scene of the train going through the tunnel is the best part of the book. Now, John says, would you say when I'm certain of some things and not of others? Yes, I think that's right. I mean, when I say I'm certain that 2 plus 2 equals 4, but I'm not certain who's going to win the election next week, that would be an example. Now, Madeline says, I'm taking class on Das Kapital, the leftist organization. They were lumping Mises and Rand together. I said they ran, and I thought Rand came up with their ideas independently. They said she was influenced by Mises and Max Stirner. To what extent would you say Rand was influenced by these or other economists? Well, she certainly read Mises, but I doubt she was influenced by Max Stirner. That's an interesting claim. But I never heard that before. I'm wondering why, you might ask why your teacher thought that. It's an interesting claim, but I don't think, I mean, he was one who was read around some libertarian circles, but I mean, her views don't seem that similar to his. I mean, he was an egoist in a certain sense, but with a quite different philosophy from hers. Oh, yes, well, it'll be a long wait. And now, to what extent would you say Mises influenced your writing and philosophy? Well, I think primarily he would have effect on her views about economics, but I don't think she got much of her philosophy. John says the future is hidden. Well, in certain respects, I would say, and not others. Can I click on the zero? Let me just try this so that let me see what happens. Zero. Which one is it? Let me just click on this. It's zero. This is this one that says this one. Yeah, here we go. Oh, there it is. Yeah, there. Oh, I see. Yeah, there's the photo. See, that's the judge, and then Ron Paul and his wife, Carol. Well, I like those ties because I get them from the Mises Institute, and I don't have to pay for them. That's the best part. John says free, no such thing. Well, I mean, somebody has to pay for it, but as long as I'm not the one, that's what I care about. Neil says, how about a course on analytical philosophy? Well, I'd certainly be willing to do that if there were demand for it. Now, Mountain, are you planning to reteach your intro to logic? Well, again, that's up to Danny. I guess it would depend on whether there's sufficient demand for it. Oh, it's very nice. People would want to take such a course. Thank you. Oh, and somebody would like to take my course on neoconservatives. Well, I mean, again, but these courses are repeated, it just depends on the demand. Now, Danny says, what readings would I cover in an analytical philosophy? Well, that's, you know, I probably just cover some of the standard ones, you know, maybe some Bertrand Russell, Wittgenstein, some of the logical positivists, Quine, you know, some of the, maybe some Kripke. Now, Neil said, difference between Wittgenstein, Russell, Frege, it's like excite people like me. Well, those would be ones to, certainly would be ones I'd want to talk about. And Jonathan Kennedy's class we take on a record base. Oh, yeah, I mean, you don't have to attend the live lecture. After I give the live lectures, the classes, the lectures are made available. They may have videos and audio tapes, so you can listen to them whenever you want. I was watching, Malcolm said, I was watching a documentary on Martin Luther. To what extent would you say influence philosophy and economics? Well, I mean, that's a difficult question. He tended to be very critical of philosophy, although if you look at, he was influenced by some of the later medieval nominalists in his own philosophy. He was kind of an Augustinian. So I think he did have some effect, you know, on some of the later German thought, especially on Kant and others. You can have quite a bit of influence on Heidegger. In economics, I don't think he had much influence on people. He was kind of against economics theory, pretty much. Uh, Neil said, I don't know if he believed everything. Sometimes Luther was exaggerating his growth, so he came across in a bad light. Oh, that's an interesting suggestion. Well, I guess we're about out of time now, so thanks, everybody. Hope to see you for Lecture 8, which is next week. As they used to say before, Britain before World War I, we want 8 and we won't wait. Thanks a lot. Now, Rock says, and where Mises go with hierarchy, right? Well, Mises didn't accept natural rights, so he wouldn't go along with, he didn't believe in natural law, so he wouldn't go along with that. Okay, thanks, everybody. Thank you.